brute force. If it doesn't work, you're just not using enough. You're listening to Soft Web Radio, Special Operations Military News, and straight talk with the guys in the community.
Hey, this is Rad with Soft Rep Radio. Thank you for being a part of our show. I want to give a shout out to our sponsor who helps keep the lights on here at Soft Rep Radio, and that's Fox Nation. So we invite you to take advantage of this offer that Fox Nation has chosen Soft Rep to help them share with you this week. Veterans and active duty service members will get Fox Nation free for a year. Let me say that again, free for a year. You can sign up for the offer here, softrep.com/Fox-Nation. That's softrep.com/Fox-Nation. We hope you'll share this with any veterans or active duty service members that you also know. Please spread the word, and thanks for being a part of Soft Rep Radio.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to Soft Rep Radio. Soft Rep Radio on time, on target. We have a very special guest for our listeners and viewers today for our YouTube channel. Toby Harnden has written a fantastic book, and we encourage all of our readers and listeners out there to check this book out. It's called First Casualty. It's about the first CIA paramilitary teams in Afghanistan when the war started back in 2001. It's a fantastic book. If you're looking for a Christmas gift to give some loved one or close, or you want to give a gift to yourself, definitely check this out. So, without any further ado, we're going to welcome Toby to the podcast. Thanks for taking the time to join us today. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks very much, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. And, you know, we were talking offline. I know our listeners always love to hear about somebody's military experience. You were in the Royal Navy. So fill our listeners in a little bit about your military career and how you got into writing.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, my military career was not very illustrious, not nearly as illustrious as the people I sort of tend to write about these days, or your career, or probably most of your listeners. I joined the Navy in 1985. So it was just after the Falklands War. In fact, I was applying for the Navy age 16. I joined when I was 18, you know, during the Falklands War. And I remember picking up the newspaper and it was Coventry sunk, HMS Coventry, a destroyer. So it was real. But, you know, I got in just after that. And I was there for just about 10 years. I left in 94. And in 1991, I tried very hard to get involved in the Gulf War, but they managed to win it without me. And I was sort of stuck back in Scotland feeling very frustrated. And, you know, I think probably, I mean, I went to lots of places. You know, I joined ships in Hong Kong twice, went around Australia twice. You know, I went to the Caribbean, the, you know, Northern Europe, Mediterranean, you know, all over the place. But it seemed like kind of not completely serious, and the Cold War was over, and I was kind of like, you know, what's the point of this? But, you know, I mean, that sort of thirst for adventure and service, that was just part of my upbringing. I'm a fourth generation military. So my father was in the Navy. His father was in the Army all through World War II. You know, he joined in the 1920s as a boy and then retired as a major. And the great-grandfather Army as well. And a great-grandfather on the other side, who was Army, who was captured in September 1914 in France and escaped from a POW camp in Germany in March 1916 and survived the war as a career infantryman sergeant in 1914. So in a way, he had a pretty good war. So yeah, I grew up, you know, listening to these stories. And, you know, we moved around a lot when I was a kid, but it was mainly in Manchester, northwest of England, kind of like, I don't know, equivalent to Detroit or somewhere. And I just wanted to get out, you know, and see the world and never go back to Manchester. And so that's what I did. And, you know, how I got into writing, I mean, I didn't see that much of a difference in a way between the Navy and journalism, you know, because it was, you know, job changes every year or two, having to deal with people at all levels from, you know, like senior officers to guys in the working in the engine room and being able to get along with everybody. And that was kind of how news journalism in a way worked for me. And it was kind of a good background, you know. And I was naturally drawn to military stuff and ended up early on in my career getting sent to Northern Ireland, which was just a fantastic job because, you know, it was still a war, you know, it was called the Troubles, but, you know, it was sort of an undeclared war within the United Kingdom, an insurgency. And at that time, there was, you know, peace talks going on. So you had that kind of interplay between the violence and the politics, which, you know, made it the biggest story in the world for a while. And it was a very small sort of patch of ground. So it meant that whenever anything went bang, I was able to go there. And it was very kind of accessible. And yeah, so that got me off on the, you know, journalism career.
Yeah, and you've written a couple of books prior to this one. What exactly, you know, got you interested in this particular story and this particular book?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's funny, you never plan it this way, but I look at the books as kind of steps. So the first one was about Northern Ireland, bandit country, about the Troubles, the IRA heartland, border heartland, you know, rural insurgency. And, you know, it had, you know, six IRA families and the IRA chief of staff sort of living on a farm, straddling the border, literally one half in the Irish Republic, one half in Northern Ireland, and therefore the United Kingdom, the IRA sniper team. They were making all the bombs in England, in South Armagh, and shipping them over. And, you know, special forces operations, one that eventually took down the sniper team. So, you know, I got into all that. And then, sort of almost 10 years later, the second book was Dead Men Risen. And actually a central figure, which was about the Welsh Guards, British battalion in Helmand in 2009. And, you know, one of the key people in that book was by then a Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornlow, who'd been a captain in the Welsh Guards in South Armagh when I was then, was a kind of a source, I guess, and became a close friend. And he was the battalion commander and was killed in action on July the 1st, 2009. And so that got me into that. They'd lost a company commander and a platoon commander in the same battalion, which was the first time those three levels of leaders have been killed in the same battalion since the Korean War. And then, you know, first casualty, it's sort of very much, you know, about Afghanistan again, obviously, but very much a kind of a 9/11 book. And I was in Washington, D.C. on 9/11, you know, walking into the kind of newspaper office just as the first plane, you know, hit the World Trade Center. And then I, you know, watched, like it, so many others, watched an airliner fly into the second one. I was like, holy shit, this is it, you know. And, you know, I was frustrated. Once again, this is a bit of a pattern, I guess. Once again, you know, I was like, I want to go to Afghanistan, you know, send me. And they're like, no, you know, you're covering the Bush administration. You got your feet under the table. There's a big story there. We've got plenty of people who can, you know, we've got the guy from China and the guy from Jerusalem, and they can go to Afghanistan. So, you know, once again, I was feeling left behind. But it was a great story, and it was a country at war. And, you know, I vividly remember Mike Spann being killed and his affiliation with the CIA immediately being sort of declared. And I remember Shannon Spann, his widow, who's also a CIA officer, giving an incredibly moving eulogy at Arlington on December the 10th, 2001. And I wrote a couple of little news stories about Mike Spann. But then everything just moved on, you know, and it was, you know, war on terror, anthrax attacks, and we were straight into Iraq. But that story of Mike Spann never quite sort of left me, and the horse soldiers and riding into battle on horseback, you know, kind of great, you know, incredible stuff. And then a couple of years later, strangely enough, I was in Iraq, in Baghdad, and sort of hanging out at the Hamra Hotel, sort of journalist hotel. And another reporter said to me, did you ever see the footage of that CIA officer in the fort, you know, who's with Mike Spann? And I hadn't seen it. And I checked it out, and it was a guy called David Tyson, who was with Mike that day. And so he'd just seen Mike being killed, joined this prison uprising, Al-Qaeda prison uprising. He'd shot his way out. And there was just a little couple of seconds of him running across the courtyard with a Kalashnikov in one hand and a pistol in the other. And then he bursts into this building, sort of straight into a German TV crew who just start asking kind of goofy questions. And I just remember seeing his eyes, his staring eyes, you know, like a thousand yard stare. And I was just fascinated by David and what he'd been through. And, you know, you could just tell he'd killed all these people. He'd seen his comrade killed. He didn't know whether he was going to be killed in the next few minutes. He didn't know what he was facing. And he could tell his brain was on complete sort of overload. And so I eventually, years later, tracked him down. 2013, I tracked him down through, he was a former, so he was a case officer based in Tashkent, linguist, Central Asian languages guy. He spoke fluent Uzbek. He'd been an academic at Indiana University before joining the agency kind of late. I think he joined in 96. And so, you know, sent an email to an academic who'd thanked him in some book acknowledgements. And I remember being in New Jersey covering Governor Chris Christie's re-election campaign and feeling pretty pissed off with the whole thing. You know?
I don't blame you there.
I mean, and he was being a complete jerk, you know, towards me.
Imagine that.
Right.
Governor Christie being a jerk.
Right. And then the phone rings and he's like, hey, it's David Tyson. And so I was like, okay, this is a little bit more interesting. So, you know, we met in the Panera Bread in Vienna, Virginia, like in the DC suburbs, very close to where I am now. And, you know, sort of bizarre, you know, just completely sort of mundane, you know, surroundings and meeting this guy that, you know, had killed all these people and been through all this stuff. And he was friendly, but he couldn't, you know, he was still serving, couldn't really engage much. But I did my best to keep in contact with him over the years. And sometimes I wouldn't hear from him for a year or two. But I became very interested in the whole Battle of Kalajangi because it had CIA, Green Berets from 5th Group. So Major Mark Mitchell, you know, got the first Distinguished Service Cross since Vietnam, leading the sort of main rescue force. There was a SEAL there, Steph Bass, who was awarded a Navy Cross the same day as Mike Spann was killed. He crawled forward sort of under fire and located the body. You had the British Special Boat Service, you know, the UK SEALs were there. You had AC-130s coming in the first time they'd been used in Afghanistan. You had a big friendly fire incident, 2,000-pound JDAM dropped on a friendly position, killing a lot of Afghans and resulting in the first 5 Purple Hearts of the Afghanistan war. You had this warlord, Abdul Rashid Dostum, right out of Central Casting, you know, this kind of brutish, sort of murderous character. And John Walker Lind, you know, the so-called American Taliban, who was actually Al-Qaeda, you know, and this sort of weedy white guy from Marin County, California. So the story just seemed to have everything in one place. And so I just thought that this, you know, this just would make a great book, a great narrative to talk to all these people. And so, you know, fast forward to late 2019 and, you know, I persuaded a publisher to give me a deal on this book. Like all book proposals in a way, or certainly all the ones I've done, it's really a leap of faith on the part of the publisher. You're saying like, this is my idea. This is the concept. I've spoken to a few people and this is kind of what I'm thinking. But trust me, it's going to be 10 times better. The finished product's going to be 10 times better. I can't tell you exactly how, because I don't know exactly who I'm going to talk to or where the path is going to lead me. But please trust me, it's going to be better. And so that's kind of what happened. I mean, I thought it was going to be a book mostly about the 6 days of Kalajangi. But once I started talking to David Tyson in depth, and then, you know, then J.R. Seeger, who was the chief, who was diary speaking case officer from Near East Division, who'd worked with the Mujahideen in the 80s. And then Justin Sapp, who was a Green Beret captain, who was seconded to the team. 29-year-old guy, youngest guy on the team, still serving as a colonel. I spoke to him. And so once I spoke to those guys, I actually began to sort of concentrate my focus a little bit more on Team Alpha. So these were the 8 guys who went in first behind enemy lines. They went in on October 17, 2001. And so I then kind of expanded the scope out, you know, concentrated more on these 8 guys, you know, but certainly all the Green Berets and the SBS and Steph Bass and all those people as well. But it became more of the story of those 8 guys at the center, of those 8 guys from 9/11 to landing on October the 17th, to capturing Mazar-i-Sharif, to Kalajangi, and then, of course, you know, Mike being killed and the sort of the repercussions of the last sort of 20 years or so. So it was kind of very much like a moving sort of target. And, you know, it just developed in the way that it did.
Yeah, you know, it's amazing because, you know, as we spoke offline, this was like a classic OSS, SOE, you know, type of story that our forebears in Special Forces and CIA, you know, that this was like the type of mission that they would have done in World War II, and going behind, becoming the insurgents themselves and linking up with a resistance force. And it was just, it's a story that needed to be told. And the amount of detail that you got into it, it's fantastic. Because you started off with, you know, 9/11 and how it all kind of transpired. And the first thing I wanted to ask you was, did you have trouble getting, you know, guys from the CIA to be able to talk to you? Did you have to go through the agency, or were you able to contact some of these guys directly?
Yeah, so, you know, I just didn't know how that was going to work. And I was kind of prepared for the possibility that none of them would speak to me. I mean, I don't know how it would have, I guess it would have become a lot more about the Green Berets if that had happened. But so I just, so David, you know, I'd already made this contact with, and I thought, I felt kind of quite strongly that he wanted to tell a story. And I know that he'd spoken to sort of internal audiences, and in a way, part of his sort of therapy was to talk about it. So I had this sense that he would talk, but it was kind of a weird, like, chicken and the egg sort of situation, because he was like, I do want to talk, but I don't want this to be about me. I want it to be about the team, and I want it to be about Mike. And, you know, so, but he was the one who was there, and I wanted him to talk so I could talk to the others. And so, you know, I had to, you know, kind of navigate that. And of course, these guys are, you know, anybody that's had any contact with CIA, and, you know, I think Green Berets are similar, you know, kind of species. They make their own decisions. So they can, there can be a recommendation from somebody else on the team, but, you know, nobody's going to be served up on a platter to you. You know, they're going to make their own decisions. And so, you know, it was nearly 20 years on. So there were six surviving. So Mark Rausenberger, the medic on the team, subsequently became a paramilitary. He died in 2016 in the Philippines on CIA duty. So there were six still living, and one was still serving, a guy called Andy, who's still serving in CIA. So we don't use his first name. But the other five had, and then there was Justin, who was still serving. But, you know, he was military, which is a different kind of creed from the CIA in terms of openness. And Justin was pretty happy to, I think he went through a PAO initially, but he was pretty happy to engage. And then J.R. Seeger, the chief, was sort of quite long retired and was writing thrillers. And so he was sort of out there. And so I went to those three first. And, you know, I was hearing about the others. Scott Spellmeyer became very senior in the agency. He was a former Ranger, wounded in action during the Battle of Mogadishu in 93, then had become a paramilitary and then became very senior station chief in Kabul, and the senior CIA guy on the NSC during the Trump administration, a non-political appointee, I should say, and he just retired. And Alex Hernandez, who was Sergeant Major, 10th Group, Special Forces, like storied career, ending up in a special mission unit, then gone on to another kind of full career in CIA ground branch. And so, you know, Andy, Scott, and Alex were the three that were going to be more difficult. Like, I was told, Alex is never going to speak to you. Quiet, professional, he's just not going to do it. Sorry. So after the first three, I knew that the others knew about me. And Shannon Spann was kind of reluctant, but I she spoke to me. And then, you know, Hank Crumpton, who was head of Counterterrorism Center Special Operations, so he was running the war day-to-day for CIA. And then Kofa Black, his boss, the director of the Counterterrorism Center, I'd done interviews with them. So I think I built up, you know, a bit of credibility and trust that I just didn't have an agenda. I wasn't an idiot. I kind of had done my homework. I wasn't wasting people's time, and I was kind of serious. And so at that point, I went to the agency, and I had no connection with them. I had no sort of, you know, in. I had to get a friend to dig out the press officer's email for me. And to my surprise and, you know, gratitude, they were very positive and almost immediately, very, very responsive. And they didn't open up the vaults and give me all their secret cables or anything. All my freedom of information requests were still turned down. But they did say to Scott and Alex, for instance, like, you know, we think this is worth doing. I mean, the agency's proud of the story, rightly so. And that was another button that I was pushing all the time, which, like, listen, you know, I mean, this isn't, you know, failing to connect the dots before 9/11. It's not, you know, no WMD in Iraq. It's not enhanced interrogation. You know, this is a pretty good story. You know, you were successful.
It's a great story.
Incredibly successful. Yeah, in just a few weeks. And so, you know, they gave the thumbs up to, you know, sort of Scott and Alex. And, you know, once I got to speak to Alex, we spoke for 5 hours, you know, the first time, you know, it, you know, I mean, it wasn't a case of me trying to stop him, but if I wanted to stop him talking, I don't think I could have done. And I mean, he's sort of still like that. Like once he's, now he's made his decision, you know, he's 69 now, he's, it's, you know, this is part of history. He's happy to talk about it. And then Andy, who was still serving, they facilitated that interview as well. So then I had all six, which was, and I had I had people's diary. You know, David had written a diary. There was video footage that had been shot. There was, you know, some documents came into my possession, you know, for, you know, via, you know, channels I won't disclose. But I was able to, you know, it was a fantastic experience to, and that's where the kind of the detail, I think, came from, which I love. I love being able to build up the granular detail and sort of complete the picture and at the same time link it to the sort of the strategic context and this sort of, you know, big moment in world history, really. And then once you have the six, you know, six people like that who've, you know, they weren't always together. The team, you know, just like the Jedburgh teams, you know, would be three men often going off for days on end. But, you know, everybody, you know, some things they've done together, but everybody had their own kind of, you know, focus, which sometimes could be a little bit blinkered. And so at a certain point, it was very sort of gratifying. I felt I was able to sort of give something back to members of the team and say, oh, I think this is what happened because, you know, Andy and Alex and Mark were doing this. Like, oh, really? Okay. And so, you know, I think, and I mean, I've been told by them that I was able to sort of make sort of sense for them of something that they'd been part of. And so, you know, it was great to be able to speak to all six of them. And at the beginning, as I say, wasn't even one of them that was guaranteed. So, you know, it's kind of funny how things work. I think COVID weirdly helped because people were a little bit sort of, you know, reflecting. People were at home and none of these guys
busy. Yeah.
Were into. Yeah, yeah, that's right. I mean, just, yeah. And people, none of these guys were into wearing masks or, you know, being isolated or anything. And neither am I. So it was like, you know, great. Yeah, come on, you know, let's sit down and talk. So, yeah, it's funny how things work out.
Yeah, right at the beginning of the book, when you talk about Kofor Black briefing the president and he's in the Situation Room and,
yeah,
you know, the conversation that transpired to me, that was the hook right there. It was like, oh, this is really good. Did you actually talk to him?
Yeah. So Kofor Black lives in Great Falls, you know, not too far from here. And he was kind of hard, you know, he subsequently worked for Blackwater and become, mm-hmm. you know, somewhat controversial figure. So, you know, and he's a wily old spy, you know, who, you know, was on the trail of Carlos the Jackal and Bin Laden had him in his sights. You know, so he, again, he's no pushover. So I had to sort of have validators contact him and stuff. And you know, you had to sort of run the gauntlet of basically, yeah, who the hell are you, you know?
Could you fill our listeners in on what he was telling the president, because I love this in the book, because I'm sure, yeah, judging from the president's reaction, he's not used to hearing people talk so straightforward as what,
yeah, he... So Kofor Black, you know, yeah, sort of a legendary Africa Division case officer who was heading the counterterrorism center, within which is the Alex Station, which is the Bin Laden unit. So they've been focused on Al-Qaeda for several years, and they've been saying, like, Al-Qaeda's coming. They're coming here. You know, we've been through the embassy bombings in East Africa in 98, the USS Cole in October 2000, the Millennium Plot. And so it's kind of no surprise, really, to Kofor Black and many of his team. And they had a plan. It was called the Blue Sky Memo, or if not a plan, a sort of concept of operations of how to operate, you know, like you said, OSS, SOE style within Afghanistan alongside the indigenous allies, you know, as the insurgents against the foreign invaders who were Al-Qaeda. And so on 9/11, it's kind of like Kofor Black is suddenly the man of the hour, you know, and Pentagon doesn't have a plan. I thought they had a plan for everything, including invading Canada, but apparently not for Afghanistan in 2001. And so George Tenet, you know, brings in Kofor Black into the Situation Room. And, you know, Kofor is, you know, he's a powerful big guy. He's a powerful presence. And he's got this, he went to some boarding school in England for a while. His father was a Pan Am pilot, you know, so he's had this unusual upbringing. And he's got this sort of theatrical kind of manner and this incredible sort of turn of phrase. And, you know, he's a case officer. And so he wanted to win over the president. And he'd worked out what type of person the president was, and particularly the president after 9/11. And we can all remember, you know, with us or against us, you know, dead or alive, you know, and go get him and all this kind of stuff. That's the type of president Bush was. And that fitted in very much with the moment, and it fitted in with Kofor Black. But he knew that speaking sort of plainly, you know, he probably wouldn't have tried this if it had been President Obama, you know, but he was like, you know, Mr. President, you know, when we finish, there'll be flies walking across their eyeballs, you know. And this is some phrase he picked up in Africa. And so Bush is, you know, and he's basically like, you know, and Kofor's like, you know, there are people going to be killed. And Bush is like, sort of, so be it. That's what he wanted. Not some kind of diplomatic kind of, you know, plan or, you know, we're going to have 100,000 troops going in 6 months' time and conventional units. You know, I mean, actually, Colin Powell said at the time, you know, the president wanted to kill someone. And that was the mood of the country. And that was the kind of the way Kofor Black framed it. And so, and Bush went for it. And so the CIA is, you know, leading the war, this, you know, tiny organization compared to DOD.
Yeah. And, you know, and then they put together the, as you said, like Team Alpha. I mean, was it 33 or 36 days after 9/11, CIA has people on the ground in Afghanistan. And
yeah, you know, well, actually in Afghanistan, so the first team that went in was Jawbreaker, which went in, I think, September 26th. So that would be 15 days afterwards.
15 days.
But they went into the Panjshir Valley, which was controlled by the Northern Alliance. So kind of a safe zone, relatively speaking. Ahmad Shah Massoud had been assassinated by Al-Qaeda on September the 9th. So they were kind of leaderless. Well, they had Fahim Khan was the new leader who was kind of useless. And they weren't fighting and they weren't moving. And so Team Alpha came in, yeah, so 17th, which I guess will be 35 days after 9/11. They were the first behind enemy lines. And they were with Dostum, who wanted to fight and had the ability to fight and did fight. But it was, you know, all kind of cobbled together kind of on the back of an envelope, you know. I mean, it was this kind of time where the bureaucracy was just pushed to one side. Of course, it all returned later on. But, you know, for those few weeks, I mean, Team Alpha was, the core of it was a four-man paramilitary team led by Alex Hernandez. But then they added on David Tyson, who was in Tashkent. So he didn't even join the team in headquarters. He was added to it right at the end, swapped out for a former SEAL. And then they added a medic, Mark Rausenberger. They added Justin Sapp late on. So they had these eight guys and they never operated together. I mean, some of them had, the four paramilitaries had, but some of them barely knew each other and they had no military kit because they, you know, in case they were captured. So Justin went with a government credit card to REI, you know, in Northern Virginia and bought a few thousand dollars worth of kit. And David didn't have anything. I mean, he just got what was in his closet, basically. He had these sort of, you know, sort of almost leisure wear, like hiking boots that he would then wore for 40 days. They took in Kalashnikovs. So everyone was using 7.62. They had Glock pistols. Or David got a high power Browning pistol from the embassy in Tashkent. And, you know, so it was very improvised. And the plan was just to get in there and work it out. And Dostum had, for the Soviets against the Mujahideen, so been on the, so J.R. Seeger, you know, had sort of, you know, he was the enemy in the 80s. And Dostum was sort of notorious for switching sides. And so, you know, nothing was guaranteed. I mean, he could have opened fire on the team when they arrived, if it's possible. And then there were Tajiks there who were nominally allies, like Atta Mohammed Noor, who was kind of the rival commander in the area. You know, he was pissed because he hadn't got a CIA team or an ODA. And so he wasn't talking to Team Alpha when they arrived. And so there was a lot to work out. And, you know, there was a possibility that Atta could have attacked Ostom and killed Americans sort of in the crossfire. And so, you know, JR had to work all that out, you know, manage the tribes, again, classic sort of OSS SOE stuff. And they took in $3 million in non-sequential $100 bills, which helped. You know, Dostum got $1 million on landing.
That always, that would help me.
Right, greases the wheels. And so again, you know, again, going back to the OSS SOE analogy, which I'm really glad you sort of picked up on, because, you know, these were the forerunners of the Central Intelligence Agency, but also Special Forces. And here we are, it's like full circle. Here we are in 2001, where you've got CIA and Special Forces, because ODA 595, the famous sort of horse soldiers, came in 3 days after Alpha, Team Alpha, to link up with Dostum. They're operating together, and they're just going back to their roots. And it was just incredible, the delegation of power. I mean, Rumsfeld eventually got upset that it looked like we were going to win with captains on the ground. So he started sending in colonels, which didn't really help. And then a two-star admiral came in, you know, once Mazar had fallen. But in these early weeks, I mean, JR was, you know, making all these decisions on the ground, talking to Hank Crumpton every day. But, you know, he was making sort of, you know, on-the-ground decisions with strategic consequences. And that was incredible. And again, of course, that changed, you know, after the victory at the end of 2001.
Right. You know, that's the amazing thing in the book. And again, our listeners out there, I encourage them to check this out, because you have a handful. You know, people think, oh, the CIA went in, there were 10,000 guys. They didn't. They went in with a handful, paramilitary guys, a couple of case officers, and, you know, a couple of special forces teams. And they took over the country until the U.S. military, the Pentagon, had to get their feet wet, because they had to hand out, you know, impact awards for guys who had no idea what they were doing. And I think that your book describes all that. But I wanted to bounce back to Dostum. As you said at the beginning of the podcast, he was straight out of Central Casting. And I thought you captured him incredibly well in the book. And what a character. I mean, he liked to play up the fact that he was a bloodthirsty, you know, evil incarnate kind of guy with his men and his enemies. Then he also tried to impress upon the Americans that he was cultured and he had a couple of Cadillacs. But my favorite part of Dostum, and I want you to expound on this, because obviously you know a lot more from writing the book, but my favorite part of the book with him was when he kicked David Tyson early one morning and he said, listen to this. And there was a woman's voice on the radio. I'd like for you to tell the story to our listeners, because that just cracked me up. I thought that was hilarious. Yeah. And it just goes to show Afghan culture is very different than ours.
Yeah, yeah. So you're right. So that's exactly the way Dostum was. He tried to sort of play it both ways, and he had this fearsome reputation, and his men were terrified of him. So he assigned bodyguards to Team Alpha guys and the members of the ODA. And so they'd have these little shadows. They'd be going for like a shit, and this Afghan would be following them and be like, just leave me alone. Don't follow. And he'd be like, you don't understand. If I let you wander off and you step on a mine and you're killed, Dostum will chop my head off. You know, that's so his own men. And of course, after this, you know, he was, you know, the man of the moment during this period, but afterwards, you know, State Department wasn't too happy with dealing with him, and he was sort of a persona non grata sort of once again. But he was, you know, he was kind of a peasant. You know, he hadn't been educated, you know, beyond the age of 12. And he'd sort of, you know, he was grown up through the military, but he was like many of these sorts of guys. He had this sort of wit and this, you know, intelligence, and he was a very sort of quick study. So, yeah, so David's just been on this sort of mission to Sir Rob to link up with Atta and bring in another ODA and Team Bravo, CIA Team Bravo. And he's, you know, he's dog tired. He spent 13 hours on the most excruciating horse ride of his life. And so he's just sort of nodding off a bit, where Dostum's on the radio but they're all on the same frequencies as the Taliban. And so there's always a lot of like sort of banter and sort of taunting and essentially kind of psyops with the Taliban, you know, like, I've got the Americans in here, they're going to kill you. You know, you need to, you know, change sides and come with me and all that. And so Dostum hears this woman's voice. Well, at first he thinks it may be like a sort of hermaphrodite, you know, some kind of, you know, eunuch or something, like because he can't conceive of a woman being in an aircraft. So he was basically thinking it's a man with no balls, you know. And so once they got over that, David's like, no, it's a woman. And so he immediately has this idea that he's going to use this against the Taliban because, you know, the concept of being killed by a woman, you know, would just sort of, you know, screw them, like, I don't know, just mess with their heads, basically. And that their whole concept of sort of, you know, society, particularly the Taliban and, you know, the position of women and all the rest of it. And so he says to David, you know, get her to sing a song. And so there's this, you know, F-16 pilot, whatever it was, Navy jet pilot. And she's like, I don't know any fucking songs. Like, you know, she's like flying a jet and wanting to drop bombs, you know. She's, you know, and Dostum's like, she doesn't know any songs. Like, well, you know, like a poem or, and anyway, so it's the Navy fight song in the end. She's like, oh, okay. So she sings this song of like, go Navy, you know, fight army and all this. Yeah. And Dostum, he gets the radio receipt. He gets one radio, he puts the two radios together, and he's like, Commander Mahmoud, you know, the Taliban commander, listen to this, you know, and there's this, you know, this woman singing this song pretty badly, I think. And then he says, so Commander Mahmoud, you know, this is an American woman, you know, who's flying the plane. And what she's saying is, she's singing, you know, I'm going to fuck you up, you know, I'm going to screw you over. I'm going to, you know, you have a small dick and, you know, I'm going to kill you. And so it's just, you know, it's sort of a joke, but it's, you know, it's classic sort of psyops about how to sort of, you know, taunt the enemy and sort of, you know, make them feel degraded. And so David thought that was incredible about just how quickly Dostum could, you know, something he couldn't really understand initially, but he grasped that this was an opportunity that he could use to, you know, use against the enemy. And that's what he did. And so, as you say, it summed up.
It was a great part of the book because then she ends up dropping bombs on the Taliban and they realize there's a woman singing up above them and they could see the bombs coming down and it's a woman dropping, which to them is horrifying because the Taliban, you know, they're so anti women being anything, but I just, you know, yeah. Dostum.
And then later on,
Go ahead.
Yeah, Dostum loved this. So he became sort of like entranced by this idea of like women killers in the skies. And so later on, there's an AC-130 navigator called Alison Black, who's still serving, I believe, as a colonel in the Air Force. She was nicknamed the Angel of Death, you know. and so once again, you know, it's the, you know, even the American women are killing you now.
That's awesome. Now, I read at the back of the book that you actually got to travel, I think it was the end of 2019, and you actually got to interview Dostum.
Yeah. So actually, it was the end of 2020. So
20.
I was just coming back from Afghanistan a year ago. And strangely enough, the guy who was my translator, then we just got him out of Afghanistan. He's living in my spare room at the moment. He just got his work permit this morning. So
awesome.
It's been kind of a crazy year for both of us. And actually David Tyson and Shannon Spann and other members of Team Justice App, other members of Team Alpha, and, you know, the broader kind of, you know, group of people has been sort of instrumental in getting Rahale's is his name, getting him out. So that's been, you know, great. And I think he's going to end up being a great American. But so I interviewed Dostum. And it was a pretty difficult interview to get. I mean, if I thought Kofa Black was hard to pin down, I mean, Dostum, you know, he's survived like 8 assassination attempts or something. And he's always been kicked out, you know, he's always in exile in Turkey. And you know, and then you have to find, you know, obviously you can't just call him up. You have to find, you know, who represents him and all that. And so eventually, you know, there was a sort of agreement that he would talk to me, at least in principle, but no date or place. And so I went out in November 2001. Sort of, I missed the US election, which was great. So I watched the results of the election on Indian TV in a hotel in Kabul, which was fine by me. I was sitting around in Kabul for a couple of weeks, getting a bit concerned about, like, is this going to happen? Because Dawson was supposed to be going to Kabul, but I really wanted to see him in Mazar-e Sharif because that was his place. Or Shebagan, actually more precisely Shebagan, which was his home base. And so eventually I got up there, and it was really difficult because the Taliban was controlling, you know, most of the country outside the cities at that point. And it really brought it home to me that this thing's over, you know, it's just a matter of time. And so I had to wait for, you know, more than a week to get a helicopter from Mazar-e Sharif. I could fly commercial air up to Mazar. But from Mazar, I had to get a helicopter. It took more than a week because Taliban controlled the roads. But then all of a sudden, you know, I'm there and there's Dostum in his big Chopin coat and he's old. Yeah, obviously, he's old. He's late sort of 60s now, but just this like sort of powerful, like emphatic presence. And he has, you know, very fond memories. I mean, I think it was probably the greatest period of his life, you know, working with the Americans in 2001. And, you know, and then almost like a little boy, you know, it's very upset and just a bit perplexed about why the Americans, you know, have not wanted anything to do with him ever since. But yeah, I mean, interviewing a warlord is definitely an experience, and I was really glad to be able to.
You know, the bloodthirsty part of him is pretty real. I know that you mentioned the one of the bodyguards who said, "Oh, well, if anything happens to you, he'll chop my head off." He was like a kind of a butcher in his own right. So I mean, and yeah. Then of course it's, you know, Dostum's wife. I guess it's not every day that women get shot by an AK twice while cleaning the kitchen, and it was supposedly an accident. I read that in the book. I'm like,
happens all the time.
Yeah. I always keep an AK behind the refrigerator, and who knows, it'll shoot twice on its own.
Right, right. Yeah. So yeah, that's certainly how his first wife met her end. And there's also a sort of, you know, famous sort of notorious incident of prisoners being killed in containers. And I think it's been hugely exaggerated over the years. And, you know, like everything with Afghanistan, the numbers, you know, go up from 100 and they're soon 1,000, and then it's 5,000 and 10,000. And, you know, and then, of course, propagandists will bring in, oh, Americans were slaughtering people. But there were people, I did ask him about this because it is the reason why he was completely cut off by the State Department and effectively the US government. Although those who fought with him in 2001 still sort of revere him. And, you know, I was surprised. I expected him to just completely deny everything. And he was sort of, well, you know, one of my commanders, you know, two of his brothers have been killed by the Taliban. He was, you know, young and emotional and, yeah, he shot up one of the containers, you know, killed a few of them. But it wasn't nearly as many as, I didn't know anything about it, and it wasn't nearly as many as everybody say. But, you know, how do you become an ethnic sort of leader in Afghanistan, which is essentially a medieval society? I mean, none of these guys have got clean hands. And, you know, that's just kind of the way it is.
Yeah, and, you know, when you're talking about the Afghan culture, there's another part of the book that was, you know, it almost turned into a bad thing, but, you know, I think it was David Tyson again. He was getting another duffel bag full of money, and he asked for some vodka. And if you explain that a little bit to our listeners, I thought this was another part of the book that, you know, it shows how different their culture and society is to ours.
Yeah. Well, also, I won't tell the story, but Dawson gets drunk on vodka at one point in the book at a crucial moment, but I'll leave that for just a teaser.
That was interesting as well, but the whole condom thing.
Yeah, right. So this is in the mountains before Mazar-e Sharif's captured, and David, because he speaks fluent Uzbek, so he has kind of the closest relationship with Dostum's guys. So one of his commanders comes to him and says, you know, his hand's shaking, he needs medicine. And there's a bit of sort of back and forth, and this guy says he wants devil's water, which is vodka. So the Uzbeks are often not particularly religious. They, you know, drink and do other stuff that Muslims shouldn't, and certainly the fighters mostly. And in fact, there was one guy who was praying all the time, and they used to mock him and tease him as being in the Taliban because he was praying. So they're not, you know, not particularly religious. And but at the same time, you know, you don't want to be seen to be, you know, asking the infidels for, you know, liquor. And so anyway, David gets some vodka sent in. He asks the station chief in Tashkent to put it in the next airdrop. And at the same time, there's another $3 million needed because the original three's sort of run out. And then Alex Hernandez is there, and he's like, oh, you know, case of vodka and, you know, $3 million. That sounds like a pretty good party. You know, why don't we throw some condoms in there? And, you know, he was just joking around. I think David knew it was a joke. But, you know, he's on the radio. He says, yeah, okay, Charlie, he's the chief of station. You know, we want some condoms as well. And so the next airdrop, it's, you know, this vodka, you know, Uzbek vodka, Uzbek condoms, and the $3 million. And so these things arrive, and the Uzbeks are like, you know, what are these? And so there's a lot of banter between David in particular and the Uzbeks about, you know, different, you know, cultural differences, and, you know, why do we stand up when we piss and they squat down, and, you know, and it's part of his sort of rapport building. And also he's just, like, in a sort of anthropological way, just fascinated by people. And so they're like, what are these things, these rubber things? And he says what they're for, you know, put them on your penis so you don't have more children than you need. And these guys are like, what? They couldn't conceive, but that would not be the right word. They couldn't believe that why would anybody want to do such a thing? So again, this like huge sort of cultural gulf between, you know, Afghans and Americans. And they're just this sort of like uproar. And basically there's a war that needs to be fought. But these Afghans are like, you know, it's kind of making them a bit crazy. Like, what are these things for? And they're like trying them on. It's making it set in there, like blowing up balloons, and they're flicking them at each other, and they're all like joking about it. And so in the end, David says, what, you know, I need to calm this thing down, because we need to get on horseback and go fighting. So he sort of calls a meeting and says, listen, I'm sorry, but it was just a joke. You don't put these things on your dicks. You put them on your rifle barrels to keep out water and dust, so they don't contaminate the weapon. I'm sorry, I was just, you know, joking around. That didn't quite explain the pictures of the sexy Uzbek ladies on the packets. But anyway, they bought it in the end, and so that was the condom story.
Right. And but, you know, the story takes a serious turn, because everything's going along swimmingly, you know, and the fly in the ointment in the book, and the way it played out on the ground, was Donald Rumsfeld. Because first he wanted, you know, he was waving a paper in front of the president. I remember reading it in the book that they weren't doing anything. And then I think it was Cover Black that said, we'll have Mazar Sharif in, you know, 24 to 48 hours. And then, of course, he was very upset because, you know, handful of CIA paramilitary guys in a green berets with, you know, one or two officers and a handful of enlisted guys are taking over the country. So then he wants to get, you know, high level officers in there. And that's when basically right at Mazar-e Sharif is where Dostum gets pushed into the background. And to me, that was the beginning of when everything started to go sour in the country.
Yeah, yeah. I think I'm really glad you picked up on that. I think that's exactly right. You know, so Mazar-e Sharif is captured. And yeah, Rumsfeld has been, you know, pushing this DIA paper that's saying it's, you know, we're going to be bogged down until the spring. But as soon as Mazar-e Sharif has fallen, the kind of atmosphere changes. So conventional army starts coming in. There's a two-star SEAL. So you've had a basically the link man with Dostum was the ODA captain, Captain Mark Nooch. He was sort of displaced by Lieutenant Colonel Max Bowers, who's the battalion commander. So they sent an ODC in. And then, you know, within a week, you know, Admiral Burke Halland, two-star SEAL, is taking over from Bowers. You can see the sort of escalation. And then also the sort of the comradeship you had between the ODA and Team Alpha, that kind of starts to change because the ODA is actually, they're initially made to do the, you know, personal protection for the SEAL Admiral. So they're not very happy about that. They're the horse soldiers and all of a sudden they're just, you know, personal security detail. And then the Green Beret mission and the CIA mission sort of starts to diverge. So the directive from CENTCOM and Task Force Dagger is that it's no longer sort of Dostum, but it's Dostum, Atta, and Moakek, who's the Hazara. They should be sort of treated as equals. CIA still doesn't see it that way, since CIA is sort of, you know, collecting intelligence. But there's this sort of sense, certainly from parts of the military, that the war's over and we can start bringing in support elements. And so November 25th, Admiral Callan's actually visiting a hospital, you know, in Mazar-e Sharif, and he's got four SBS who are protecting him because ODA 595 managed to get off that detail. They've gone to Kunduz, where the main fight is expected. But, you know, this kind of bond and this rapport between 595 and Team Alpha has just been sort of diluted, and 595 are not with them anymore. And I think that's one of the reasons why on the morning of November 25th, 2001, David Tyson and Mike Spann end up going to the fort on their own. And in fact, it's been a directive from Task Force Dagger that Green Beret should not go into the fort that day because it was a suicide grenade attack that killed two of Dostum's commanders the night before. And so there's a sort of a different perception of risk, not on the ground, but, you know, further up the hierarchy where the military is like, you know, that's not safe. And the CIA is like, we're going to take the risk because we need to go talk to Al-Qaeda. And you're right. That's one of the things, you know, that kind of shift was, you know, a big contributing factor in, you know, Mike Spann being killed and the uprising taking place.
Yeah, because, you know, you could, again, I mean, I wasn't there, but reading the book and you talk to all these people, you could sense everything which had been so tight and so, you know, working so well. All of a sudden now everything's pushing apart and everyone wants their own piece of the pie. And, you know, the State Department didn't, you know, to them, Dostum was unpalatable. So they bring in Atta, who, you know, just judging from the way you wrote the book, I don't have a very high opinion of this guy. But, you know, I just thought that you could sense that at that point, you could see where everything was going and it wasn't going in a good direction. And, you know, I was wondering in my own mind reading the book, if they hadn't sent the ODA off, would those guys have either accompanied Mike Spann or would they have said, hey, you know, they'd have talked to him and said, it's probably not a good idea. We can maybe get some of Dostum's guys to bring these guys out for you to talk to him.
That's a great question. And I have definitely thought about that. And initially, I know that that's the view of guys, most of the guys in the ODA 595, and certainly Captain Mark Nooch. And initially, I was a little bit skeptical about that. But I now think, having, you know, thought about this a lot and talked to just about everybody, I don't think it was anybody's fault.
No.
But I think the dynamic, and yeah, I'm certainly not going to sit here in Northern Virginia 20 years later and say, oh, if only they'd done this, or they didn't follow procedures. Mm-hmm. Or no, I mean, that they needed to go in there and question Al-Qaeda. They'd been relying on Afghan allies all the way through. They'd been taking risk every day. And, you know, it was a national
priority. That's why Mike Spann was there.
Find out. Yeah. Yeah, and he was the personification of, and he was the personification of, like, send me. I'm going, you know, I want to get to Al-Qaeda. I want to stop the next attack. And so they were always going to go in there. But I do think that if 595, those 12 guys from that ODA had been in Mazar-e Sharif, I think they would have said, ah, we're going to send a couple of guys with you. Now, David and Mike, now, first of all, there should have been three that day, but Justin was pulled off. He had to go deliver a vehicle. So again, it's just when bad things happen, it's just this combination of factors. If there'd been three of them that went in, Justin was, you know, Green Beret, it would have been a different day. But, you know, there could have been other days where one thing had changed, that would have been, you know, sure, a terrible day sure as well. But, you know, that's just the nature of life in these imperfect circumstances. So David and Mike were content with being protected by the Afghans. They didn't know that Dostum had left, not even his B team, but really kind of a C team behind. They didn't know that the Afghan, well, they had a sense, but they didn't know the extent to which the Al-Qaeda, the 400 Al-Qaeda prisoners, and they were Al-Qaeda, not Taliban. There were no Afghans amongst them. The extent to which they hadn't been searched. And so, if they'd had all that knowledge, then they probably would have made a different decision, but they acted on the best information they had. But they were okay with going in without Green Beret. They weren't saying, we need security. And that wasn't the way the agency and the Green Berets operated. I mean, the Green Berets were not there as security for the CIA. But I do think that if 595 had been there, you know, Mark Neutral, you know, Bob Pennington, the warrant on the team, or one of them would have said, I know you say you don't want anybody. We're going to send a couple of guys. They would have been okay. You know, it just would have been that different dynamic. So that's a really perceptive question, because I think it gets to the sort of heart of sort of what happened and, you know, why sometimes bad things happen, you know, and it's only afterwards when we look back and we can.
Yeah, they planned on having an uprising. They weren't there to surrender. That was the, you know, what came out in the end. But another interesting part was the fact that, you know, some of the people, even in the agency, started to question David Tyson later on and Billy Waugh, who's a legend in both CIA yes and Green Berets. He was like, nope, they didn't do anything wrong. And I think that would be, if Billy Waugh says it's okay, then it's okay.
Right. So exactly. So Billy Waugh, so he went in on at age 72 on Team Romeo. So I think he celebrated his 92nd birthday a few days ago. But he was in Tashkent on November 25th when the uprising was happening. And I mean, he called it, he said, you know, David Tyson, you know, who was subsequently awarded the Distinguished Intelligence Cross. So, you know, the CIA sort of equivalent of the Medal of Honor, the highest award. And I think only maybe about three dozen of those have been awarded in the agency's history. He said, you know, a guy did everything anyone could have done. And I mean, he, when Mike Spann, you know, killed a few of the prisoners and was sort of overwhelmed and was able to shout, Dave, 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 and David Tyson ran towards him and killed the guys on top of him. And so, you know, he could have run in the opposite direction or he could have frozen. So, I mean, he was extremely heroic. But Billy Waugh also said, you need to look after this guy because people are going to question it. And certainly, I mean, you know, Justin Sapp, you know, told me about, you know, sitting in the CIA cafeteria, you know, before Mike's even buried, you know, and people go, oh, what were those two guys thinking? Just, you know, walking into that situation. And, you know, actually Brian, it didn't put it in the book, but Brian, who was a Marine, who's still serving, very senior in CIA now, was a Marine with Mike Spann, was on Mike Spann's course at the farm, along with Shannon, who subsequently married Mike. He said that, you know, in Iraq in, you know, 2004, there's some Marine officer, you know, trying to sort of mansplain, you know, why they'd made all these mistakes in Kalajangi in 2001. And Brian's like, hang on a minute, you know, I know what happened there. And so that's just, you know, the nature of things, isn't it? That you'll get people who weren't there. And, you know, sometimes other people like journalists and, you know, commentators years afterwards, and I really, really try not to do this, who just, you know, without knowing any of the context, you know, with 2020 hindsight, we'll start saying, oh yeah, well, this is the way it should have been. And so David's, yeah, he's had to face a little bit of that over the years. It's not usually to his face, and he's a very sort of disarming person. Like, so he will sort of engage, and he doesn't portray himself. I mean, I think he is, but he doesn't portray himself as a hero. And he, you know, he talks about the fear he experienced and how, you know, a couple of days later, his hand was shaking so much that his rifle was knocking against a tank and he was wondering what that knocking sound was. But, you know, I guess that comes with the territory, and, you know, but but it makes things tough when you put that alongside survivor's guilt and, you know, losing a friend and a and comrade. It's just sort of, you know, I guess part of what you have to deal with.
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, like everyone else at the time, I heard about Mike Spann at the time it happened. And then later on, I did see that video of David Tyson in the compound. And, you know, at the time I thought this was a really small compound. But, you know, after reading your book, I looked at, because, of course, Google Maps, you can find pictures of everything.
Yeah.
That was really a large place. Because at the time, you know, as I'm reading the book, I was like, I had in my mind it was really tiny. And I was like, they dropped a 2,000-pound JDAM. If it was that, it's as small as I had it in my head, there wouldn't have been anybody alive inside there. But it was actually a lot larger. And the guys who went in, and you talked about that in the book, that was so well written, and the detail in it was fantastic, because you had the feeling you're transported right there with the guys like Mark Mitchell and the SBS guys that went in to try to retrieve Mike's body.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, yeah, so it's, you know, I was there a year ago. It was amazing to be able to get there, and it just helped me just understand. I mean, I always believe in, you know, going to the place and putting that sort of boots on the ground, because it's very hard to understand an incident without sort of being there and seeing, you know, how high the walls were. And as you say, the distances and, you know, what you could see from which angle. But yeah, it's a big place. It's like 19th century fort, you know, built out of mud, you know, sort of 12 feet thick walls, and these tower, you know, so basically, you know, you have towers north, south, east, and west, and then on like three of the, you know, like northwest, northeast as well. And so, and of course, the, you know, it's like a medieval fort, you know, you're exposed on the parapets between the towers. So when they got there, the 15-man rescue team split up, and five of them had to sort of go around counterclockwise from the east side to the northwest tower. And there were mines there, so they had to basically cross a minefield. And there was kind of ordnance, because there were shipping containers full of weapons that were kept in Kalajangi, which Al-Qaeda obviously got their hands on immediately. So there's like RPGs and mortars and all sorts of stuff, like sailing over the walls, you know, landing sort of pretty close to them. And then to get into the fort, one of the Uzbeks took his turban off and just sort of tossed it over the side. So like Rapunzel. So they used the turban to climb up, and they had all these, you know, weapons and heavy backpacks and stuff. So they're like swinging around, and actually Rapunzel stepped back, injured his finger doing that. And they're sort of having to climb up this turban. So, yeah, I mean, it was, you know, incredible to, it's just, you know, I'm a great believer in that the best stories in life are true. And I kept on hearing these sort of these details of what they've been through that, you know, you just couldn't really make up.
You know, that action at Jalajangi, it was the beginning of what would later transpire, the great cooperation. I mean, you have CIA guys, Green Berets, SBS guys, Navy SEAL. You know, probably at that time frame, they weren't used to all working together.
Yeah.
This was like the first time. Now, of course, what later transpired in Afghanistan, these guys would all work together much closer, but that was the first, probably, you know, example of that happening, which I found interesting because, you know, when I first heard about what happened there, I didn't realize there was SBS guys there. And they really put some thunder down with the machine guns on the Taliban, not the Taliban, the Al-Qaeda guys in the compound.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, the funny thing about the SBS is Tony Blair was trying to have his cake and eat it, really, because he wanted the troops, you know, shoulder to shoulder, and he wanted the troops in. But he didn't want them being involved in a bloodbath in Kunduz, which is what his sort of generals were telling him. And so he put it on this national caveat that they couldn't take part in offensive actions. So they had to basically wait to be fired on. And so the SBS were not particularly happy about that, because that meant they couldn't be involved in, you know, what looked like it was going to be the big fight in Kunduz. And they were even made to paint their Land Rovers white, so they looked like sort of humanitarian sort of vehicles. But they did have GPMGs. And so you know, once the uprising happened, you know, the SBS basically like, well, fuck that, mate. You know, we're going to the fort. And they, you know, ran towards the sound of gunfire with their GPMGs, hauled them up this. So I went up the stairs. There's this little tower on the sort of this little gateway and little courtyard, and then the eastern tower, all these like winding steps. And so they just like hauled up their GPM, you know, took them off the Land Rovers, hauled them up the stairs and set them up on the eastern tower, which looks down over the southern compound and this the pink house, which is the main building where the prisoners have been kept in the cellar and brought out that morning. And it was, the cellar was fort, it was a, like a fortified bunker because there'd been armaments kept in there, which was a problem because you couldn't destroy it. And they, you know, they took refuge in there and used that as a sort of base. But the SBS got in there and killed, I don't know, scores and scores of them with their GPMGs. And there's a little bit of footage that you can find on YouTube that some Afghan took of them sort of, you know, just blasting away with their GPMGs. Yeah.
I saw that. I looked that up, and they were bringing some thunder down on those Al-Qaeda guys. And yeah, I have a good friend of mine who was an SBS guy. We worked private security together. So those guys have always had my respect. And it was funny because you mentioned at the time they were considered like the weak sister to the SAS. But I don't think anyone thinks about them as that anymore.
No, absolutely. No, I mean, there was, yeah, the SAS in Hereford and the SBS were seen as like, you know, redheaded stepchildren or whatever the phrase is. And but this sort of put them on the map. And so they, you know, it's ironic because if it hadn't been for this national caveat and the restricted ROEs, they would have been in Kunduz, and so they wouldn't have been there. And so God knows what would have happened in terms of the uprising. I mean, David Tyson might have been killed, you know, the whole, you know, they could have taken over Mazar-e Sharif, which was the plan, which is like the Trojan horse plan. But no, they were in the right place, the right time, and they just, you know, they just stepped up. And you're right, I mean, it's an incredible moment really of, you know, for the first time, of just cooperation between all these elements. Now, I mean, you know, it was kind of messy at times. I mean, you know, the dropping a 2,000 pound JDAM, you know, was a pretty big mistake, which was a pilot error, actually, who pilots switch around the coordinates. But then, of course, procedures were streamlined so that you didn't pass up friendly coordinates, because a similar thing happened on December the 5th in Taran Kote, where three Green Berets were killed. So there were certainly kinks to be worked out, but it did just show that, you know, really, at the end of the day, certainly with the Brits and the Americans, and also the different elements of, you know, Green Berets, SEAL, US Air Force, US Marines, in the air, you know, it's all of one company, really, all one breed at the end of the day.
Yeah. So I have to ask you, you're now a naturalized American citizen. Is your wife American?
So I'm divorced. My ex-wife is American and my girlfriend is American. But I got a Greek.
So I know you had two daughters.
I have a son and a daughter.
Oh, you have a son and a daughter.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Did they speak with an English accent?
No, they don't. They say words like trousers and stuff sometimes, but they're basically American. And in fact, I've been American since 2009. And I think, 9/11 was one of the reasons why I became American. I mean, just I think being here on that day had a big effect on me, like it did many people. But they're eligible. The kids are eligible for UK citizenship, but I haven't done it yet. I must do it because you can't have too many passports in life. It's good to, you know.
The reason I asked that is after my military days were over, I worked private security. I worked on a couple of Hollywood films as the security advisor for the overall, you know, production. And on one of them, there was only like three Americans on the crew, me being one of them. And all the Brits picked up on my Boston accent because they were like, we can tell where you're from. And they could imitate my Boston accent very, very easily. They could fall right into it. And then I would try my best to do an English accent. And they were like, not everyone's Cockney. He's like, all you Americans, all you do is Cockney accents.
Yeah.
And I thought that was pretty funny. But
Well, I'm pretty useless at American accents. I can't do them. And obviously, I've pretty much kept my British accents.
Well,
but in Britain, there's so many. And in fact, on this SBS team, you know, it's a small island, but the regional variations in accent and dialect are sort of incredible. And, you know, on that team, there was, you know, a Geordie, there was somebody from the West Country, there was somebody from Yorkshire. And so actually some of the Green Berets were kind of like, you know, what's that guy speaking?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I can understand all the British accents, but the American ones, you know, I can tell when somebody's from Minnesota or Boston. But
one of my British friends, ex-military, I visited him in England. We traveled all over. And it was funny because you don't traveling that far, but the accents would change. And then we went up almost in Scotland. And when we first got there, I said to my friend, "Hey guy, are these guys speaking English? Because I can't understand anything they say." That accent was really strong. But
yeah, I mean, I was stationed in Rosyth in Fife, and some of the locals there. I mean, it was like, you needed subtitles for an Englishman. It was pretty hard to understand them.
yeah. But no, I loved it over there. I still have some good friends from there, so that's great. But again, Toby, thank you for taking the time today. I know our listeners out there, our readers from softrep.com, they will really enjoy this book. It's a great book. I think it's a story that needed to be told. And, you know, the detail that's in this about how a handful of CIA paramilitary guys, Green Berets, with some air power behind them, basically took Afghanistan. And then, you know, it's funny. I spoke with a deputy director of the CIA that ran the Afghanistan operation against the Russians with the Mujahideen. You know, he told me, he was like, "We ran it perfectly right up until the end. And then," he said, "and then we fucked it all up."
Yeah.
That's what happened here. But I encourage all our readers out there and listeners, First Casualty, CIA, you know, secret, you know, or first paramilitary guys on the ground in Afghanistan. Please check it out. Toby, thank you very much for joining us. Thanks for taking the time today. We really appreciate it. And thank you for sharing your book with me.
Thanks so much, Steve. Well, happy to be on the show. And yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Soft Rep Radio.